That thing I did, that terrible thing, is the only thing I have. That's reality, my reality. And I'm accepting it now.
Can you forgive yourself?
Yeah, I can. I don't know how, but I can forgive myself.
His family will never forgive me, though. They want to kill me.
But myself, yeah, I will not let it bring me down. I've got to move on with my life. I mean, it'll always be there, but I've got to move on and stay positive and stay focused on living. I have to. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but I can't dwell in the past and let it bring me down. Otherwise, I'm fucked.
Have you ever communicated with the family?
No, they're very, very prejudiced against white people. It was a native guy I killed, and they're very, very prejudiced.
I suppress my urge to point out that a family's grief and anger or even vengeful feelings in such circumstances do not necessarily imply racial bigotry.
Forgiveness is an important concept in the native community.
Yeah, not for this one. I know. That's why I left Saskatchewan. They're looking for me.
Let me suggest something to you. You mean write a letter to myself? To them? I know exactly what you're going to say.
That is what I was going to say. You see? You're listening to your heart.
It makes sense, doesn't it? Says Remy, enthused. I could try that just to see how it would make me feel. I'll bring it to you and you read it. We'll talk about it. I'll take my medications. I like to write first thing in the morning. I've been thinking about it. As soon as you mentioned it, I knew what you were going to suggest. This might help clear my mind a little more. I think about it every day. I'm not into taking people's lives. You know, this happened 11 years ago. I've often seen Remy hyper, but never so charged with purpose. Later the same week, Remy is back in my office, reading his composition, simultaneously nervous and triumphant. His rabbit eyes dart about, skipping from the paper he grasps in both hands to my face, constantly gauging my reaction. As he speaks, he sways, shifting his weight back and forth from one foot to the other.
To whom it may concern, you do not know me, although the name on the envelope might ring a bell. I am the individual who took your son's life on the 14th of May, 1994. The reason I'm writing this letter to you is just to let you know that there is not a day that has gone past since that tragic night took place when I do not think of what I have done. I do not expect forgiveness on the part of the family. But I feel I must write this to you to let you know how very sorry I am that it happened, and that how wrong I was. This has been eating away at me from 11 years now, and I really don't think that the horrendous disregard and disrespect I have brought upon and done to your son at such a young age by ending his life at 19 will ever leave my mind. I'm hoping that the hatred you might have had for me is not as strong as it was in 1994. But if so, I understand and can hold no ill feelings toward you or your family for this. I am truly and totally sorry for what I have done. I no longer drink alcohol, pop pills like there's no tomorrow. I don't do heroin anymore, and I have finally given up cocaine, which is at the root of all evil. Basically, I'm writing to say I'm so very sorry for what I've done to you and your family, and I hope one day you will find peace.
Remy never did mail the letter. He gave it to me as a keepsake. I wish I could report that he successfully kept the cocaine monkey off his back. He has been unable to do that, and as a consequence, I had to discontinue his methylphenidate prescription. His intentions foundered when, shortly afterwards, he entered into a hopelessly overwrought relationship with a mentally unstable woman, even more dependent on cocaine than he was. There is in Remy an unquenchable optimism and a vital sense of humor. The light of possibility continues to glimmer in him, if only uncertainly. It's a spark I'm convinced that will never be extinguished. His confession and his letter, unsent though it remains, eased his burden. His contrition was deeply felt, his relief palpable. Although not free of cocaine, he says he's using much less than in the past. I believe him. Perhaps another conversation, another moment of contact with me or with someone else, will help him move forward again. As I do final revisions on the manuscript in October 2007, I'm happy to note that Remy has for the past 2 months stayed clear of cocaine and is doing well on methylphenidate.
My mother calls me Canada's most famous junkie, says Dean Wilson sardonically. I probably am.
Dean is a well-known figure at political events and international conferences about drug addiction. One of the founders of VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, he has been a tenacious and articulate advocate of decriminalization and harm reduction policies, a prime mover in the establishment of the pioneering supervised injection site, also known colloquially as the safe injection site. A Senate committee on addictions hailed his presentation as one of the most inspirational they had heard. Dean is a thin, edgy figure with brimming over energy that keeps him physically in motion even when he's sitting or standing. He speaks rapidly, leaping from one topic to another, interrupting himself only to chuckle at his own witticisms. He's 50 years old, but like many people with ADD, looks younger than his age. He knows I've also been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, and laughs uproariously when I tell him my theory that we ADD folk look young because all the time we spend tuning out doesn't add to our years. Dean's fame spread after the international showing of filmmaker Nettie Wilde's award-winning documentary, Fix, The Story of an Addicted City. In the opening scene, Dean, in business clothing, walks briskly down Hastings and tells how he once received a prize from IBM for selling more personal computers than any other salesperson in Canada. In the next scene, bare from the waist up, he displays his tattoo-covered torso and arms as he injects himself with pure heroin.
Sometime before this video's over, I will be straight, he promises the camera.
That hasn't happened. Dean has used heroin intermittently and cocaine more consistently. He is on methadone. Occasionally he's tried to scam me, and at times he's likely succeeded in doing so, but now he's very direct in acknowledging his substance intake.
It's taken me a while to trust you, he says, but I love it that when I'm fucking up, I can tell you that I'm fucking up.
A statement which, for all I know, may be another scam. More recently, he's been clean of all injection drugs for a few months and is feeling optimistic and energized.
Tune in again next time for another exciting episode, he jokes about his ongoing battle.
Dean's one-room apartment at the Sunrise Hotel is a far cry from the expensive home he used to own in South Vancouver, when he was a single father, bringing up his three children and earning hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
I had a computer business, he says, selling microcomputers back when they were $40,000 apiece. I would use my heroin in the morning and later at night. I did that for 12 years. Every second weekend, the kids would go see their mother. As soon as they were on that bus, I would shut the drapes, lock the doors, and get totally wasted until Sunday when they came back. And then I would do the straight blue suit and tie thing and do the weekends with baseball and soccer for the next 2 weeks, just dying until I could close that door again and get high. It became harder and harder and harder to keep up the facade. I was lying to everybody, including myself. When I fell down, I really fell down. My wife, formerly a heavy drug user, finally straightened out and the kids left to live with her. I immediately got back into cocaine. I hadn't used cocaine in 13 years. I blew $180,000 in 6 months. And before I knew it, I was living down here in the Cobalt Hotel. The Cobalt is another downtown Eastside residence, not under the Portland umbrella. Despite Silver Spoon early years in a wealthy adoptive family and a successful business life, Dean spent 6 years in prison for drug-related crimes. What's the worst thing you've ever done? I ask. Dean winces as he tells me about an incident in jail that still revolts him for its cruelty and physical sordidness. Nothing would be served by repeating it here. You're only the second person I've ever told this, he says. His longtime partner, Anne, was the first. I saw and did some terrible things in jail. I could never talk about it. Anne finally told me to write it up. I wrote on for 15 pages, couldn't stop. 3 months later, she asked me to read it to her. I read it out. I finally voiced it. I turned and looked at her and said, "You did it. You got it out of me." It made it a lot easier. And then I burned those pages. As I purged that shit, I realized I had to bring light back into my life. Otherwise, all the horror I'd seen and done would have been for nothing. There's got to be some light. I believe there is a truth.
For lack of another word, I'll use spiritual truth. It's not God or this or that, but the fact is, the world is good. It all equals up to good, and I want that goodness in me. That's why I'm so into this activism part. The whole idea behind Vandu was to trust the untrustworthy, help the helpless. Then we became very political. We've taken on governments, changed politics in this city. I've led senators on a walkabout of this neighborhood, showing them it's more than just drugs. It's a community. That so many political leaders now support harm reduction, that's our doing. Whether or not Dean's organization can take all the credit for this small but significant shift in the political wind, it's an initiative to be proud of. Former Mayor Philip Owen at one point said all the addicts should be taken to the army base at Chilliwack. 2 years later, he was advocating for the SIS, supervised injection site. We took over City Hall and walked in with a coffin to symbolize all the overdose deaths. Counselors said, get them out of here. I said, I just need 5 minutes. Mayor Owen gave us 5 minutes, and I have to hand it to him, he listened to us. Now he's internationally known for his leadership in harm reduction, and as a city, Vancouver is known for that. And who were we? Just a bunch of junkies. The little bits of light in this community are not publicized enough, Dean goes on. In his hotel, there are 3 or 4 older people. If Dean doesn't see them for 24 hours, he does a room check. Others, he says, will look out for him. Many of the sex trade workers are also part of a buddy system. If one doesn't show at the end of the day, the buddy will set things in motion to find her. In the days when I used to live in the West End, I'd get into the elevator and never look at anyone, just stare at the floor or the ceiling or the numbers as they lit up, one after another. I didn't know my neighbors. In my building, I know everybody, and down here, it's like that everywhere. In his hyperkinetic way, which makes him look as if he's jogging even when he's sitting still, Dean continues, cynicism is rife down here, but at the same time, most of us want to see that we're looking after each other. We have the feeling that no one else is going to look after us. For most people down here, no one ever has, and so we have to care for each other. It's done at the most basic level, just, how are you? How are you getting along? And then you leave the person alone. We somehow balance all the ripping each other off with the caring. There's a lot of warmth, a lot of support. Dean knows that isolation is in the very nature of addiction. Psychological isolation tips people into addiction in the first place, and addiction keeps them isolated because it sets a higher value on their motivations and behaviors around the drug than on anything else, even human contact. Rip-offs happen, but being part of the community is important, even if it's the poorest postal code in the country. This is the last club. If you can't belong to this club, I say, you can't belong to any club. There are many volunteers, committed caregivers, and support groups in the downtown East Side. Innovative programs are often initiated on shoestring budgets, with the participation of people who were only recently wired to narcotics or other drugs. Judy, quoted in Chapter 3, has given up cocaine completely. She volunteers with other members of a night patrol, acting as guardian angels to sex trade workers. We keep an eye on them. We speak with them just to say hello or to kid around. We ask if they need any help. We give out condoms. We make them feel there's someone around they can turn to if they're in trouble. The transformation in Judy's self-perception, the rise in her self-esteem since she's begun to serve the needs of others in a genuine way, is wondrous to behold. In a recent photograph, she radiates a confidence and sense of purpose that were unimaginable just 1 year ago when she was on IV antibiotics for a near-crippling spinal infection and had to wear a metal brace drilled into her skull. I've been through infections many times, but this was a really serious one, Judy told me shortly after her treatment was completed. Having the steel halo on all that time, and being limited and feeling screws bolted in my head, it was definitely an eye-opener. Yeah, every time I get any using thoughts, I just remind myself what I went through for the last 5 months, and it's just not worth the chances. When I was using, I had tunnel vision, she now recalls. I didn't really notice that life was still existing around me. I just knew my little world. What I wanted was what I revolved around. When was I going to have my next fix or next toke or whatever? Now I actually go for walks a couple of times a day, and I go out, and I see all the people and all the tourists, and I say, hi, how you doing? I don't know what's wrong with me, and it's so strange. It's a good feeling. I'm liking it. But it's all so weird. Is this going to stop? Is this going to change anytime soon? I'm not trying to be pessimistic. It's just that it's so unusual, so foreign to me.
Part 2. Physician, heal thyself. The meaning of all addictions could be defined as endeavors at controlling our life experiences with the help of external remedies. Unfortunately, all external means of improving our life experiences are double-edged swords. They are always good and bad. No external remedy improves our condition without, at the same time, making it worse. Thomas Hora, M.D., Beyond the Dream, Awakening to Reality. Chapter 9. Takes One to Know One. It's hard to get enough of something that almost works. Vincent Felitti, M.D. It's not one of my Portland days, but the work won't leave me alone. Susan, our health coordinator, rings me on my cell, sounding exasperated. Mr. Grant is back here at the hotel. What should we do? I stifle a profanity. I have no patience for treating addiction today. I'm supposed to be at home, writing a book about it. Mr. Grant is Gary, a barrel-bellied, gray-bearded bear of a man, with HIV and diabetes, both risk factors for infection. Neither condition deters him from injecting any accessible vein in his foot with cocaine. His upper arm vessels are too scarred and corroded by chemicals to serve. A large ulcer is eroding his right big toe, its black base oozing with the breakdown products of dead flesh. For 2 weeks, we'd been urging Gary to accept hospitalization since it was still possible that intravenous antibiotics could save his toe. Yes, tomorrow, he'd say. But tomorrow never came. 4 days ago, late on Friday evening, I sought him out in his 8th-floor room. The home care nurses treating the wound had called in desperation. Would you commit him on mental health grounds? Loath to use that ultimate weapon on someone in no way psychotic, just addicted, I promised to see what I could do. I was prepared to pull out the pink slip of involuntary committal, but only as a final resort. Gary had just come in from scoring a deal. Like many in the downtown East Side, he supports his habit with what his longtime friend Stevie once mockingly called a self-initiated, self-organized marketing endeavor. He makes just enough to keep himself in his substances of choice. Only 2 weeks before, Stevie had died of liver cancer. Gary had been very close to her, a fellowship of free trade advocates, in Stevie's words. Intensely distressed by Stevie's demise, Gary had been on an extended cocaine binge since her death. Everybody's worried about you, Gary, I said. That's why I'm here. Well, I'm worried about me too. Just then, Kenyon appeared in the doorway, leaning on his cane. Got any crystal, Gary? He asked in his keening voice, slurring his words and seemingly oblivious of my presence. Fuck off, you idiot. Can't you see the doctor's here? Okay, Kenyon replied soothingly, as if humoring an obstreperous little child. I'll be back. He hobbled off, the tap-tap of his wooden cane on cement echoing away down the hall. You could lose your foot, I resumed. The gangrene is spreading.
I can see that. If you tell me I have to go to hospital, I will.
I appreciate your confidence in my opinion. I only wish I could be equally confident in your capacity to fulfill your intentions, honorable as they are. The bite in my tone is deliberate. You promised the same last week, and since then, the ulcer has doubled in size. Will you go tonight?
Not on a Friday night. I'll be in Emerge until the morning. Tomorrow.
Gary, I hate to even say this, but if by tomorrow at 11 a.m. you haven't left for the ER, I'm going to declare you mentally incompetent and commit you on the grounds that you're endangering your own health. You want the truth of it? I don't think for a minute you're crazy, but you're acting crazy, so I'll do it.
It's the same line I'd used on Devin a few months back when he'd refused treatment for a spinal abscess that could have left him quadriplegic. I rarely resort to such threats, as I find them ethically unjustifiable, and for the most part, valueless in practice. I did hospitalize Devin under duress, however, and he's thanked me for that since, many times over. Next morning, Gary did get himself to hospital, only to be discharged with an ineffective antibiotic. The hotel staff had not called me in time, and I'd had no opportunity to communicate with the ER physician. Arranging Gary's admission and linking him up with the appropriate specialists had been Sunday's work. And now, on Tuesday, he'd absconded from the HIV ward and fled back to the Portland. He'd passed the point of antibiotic salvage. Toe amputation was scheduled for Wednesday. Although it's my midweek writing morning, Susan believes Gary's situation is too delicate for the doctor who's filling in for me. I agree to drop in, and if compelled, to play the pink slip card. I hear Susan's voice soften in relief. Heading downtown, I'm thrown a curveball by the addicted voice in my own head. Sakura's? Just for a minute? No, I tell myself, tempted as I am, that would be impossible to justify. I arrive at the Portland to find that Gary, mercifully, has returned to hospital in the nick of time, just before he would have lost his bed. Good, I think to myself. I'm tired of having to drag people to healing by the scruff of their neck. With that, I drive away from the downtown east side, that woeful planet of drug users and dealers who hustle, grind, cheat, and manipulate 24/7 to feed their habits. I'm on my way to St. Paul's Hospital, where, in addition to my Portland work, I provide medical care to psychiatric inpatients. I take my usual route. Exit the Portland parking garage, left out of the alley onto Abbott, right onto Pender. Two blocks past Abbott, my pulse quickens as I approach Sikora's, without doubt one of the world's great classical music stores. Agitating my mind and body are thoughts of a CD of operatic favorites by the tenor Rolando Villazón. I listened to selections yesterday when I went to the store to pay off my latest debt, but resisted the urge to purchase. Today it's clamoring for me to return and pick it up. I must have it, and I must have it now. The desire first arises as a thought, and rapidly transforms itself into a concrete object in my mind, with a weight and a pull. It generates an irresistible gravitational field. The tension is relieved only when I succumb. An hour later, I leave Sikora's with the Villazón disc and several others. Hello, my name is Gabor, and I am a compulsive classical music shopper. A word before I continue. I do not equate my music obsession with the life-threatening habits of my Portland patients. Far from it. My addiction, though I call it that, wears dainty white gloves compared to theirs. I've also had far more opportunity to make free choices in my life, and I still do. But if the differences between my behaviors and the self-annihilating life patterns of my clients are obvious, the similarities are illuminating and humbling. I have come to see addiction not as a discrete, solid entity, a case of either you got it or you don't got it, but as a subtle and extensive continuum. Its central, defining qualities are active in all addicts, from the honored workaholic at the apex of society to the impoverished and criminalized crack fiend who haunts Skid Row. Somewhere along that continuum, I locate myself. I've been to Sikora's several times a week in the past 2 months, not to mention brief forays to the Magic Flute on 4th Avenue and lightning visits to Sam the Record Man and HMV in Toronto during a recent speaking tour, to say nothing of the closing out sale at Tower Records in New York. As of now, mid-February, I've blown $2,000 on classical CDs since the new year. I've broken my word to stop binging, pledged with maximal contrition to my wife, Ray, after my $1,000 pre-Christmas and Boxing Day splurge. Day in, day out, I've obsessed about what music to get and spent countless hours poring over write-ups on classical music websites. Time that could have been devoted to family or to writing this book with its rapidly approaching deadline. But as soon as the reviewer says something like, "No self-respecting lover of symphonic, choral, piano music should be without this set," I'm done for. Suddenly, I cannot imagine my life without this Dvorak symphony cycle, or that version of Bach's Mass in B minor, or this interpretation on period instruments of Haydn's Paris symphonies. I cannot abide another moment without Rachmaninoff's Preludes or Le Nozze di Figaro, Bachianas Brasileiras, a collection of Shostakovich's chamber music, yet another 14 CD version, my fifth, of Wagner's Ring Cycle, new issues of Bach's solo violin or solo cello pieces. This very day I must have Locatelli's L'Arte del Violino, Rautavaara's Garden of Spaces, the Diabelli variations, Pierre Hantai's latest rendition of the Goldberg variations on harpsichord, Schnittke's or Henze's or Mozart's complete violin concertos, my third version. I read and write, eat, and even sleep with music in my ears. I cannot walk the dog without a sonata, a symphony, an aria sounding on the earphones. My thoughts and feelings and inner conversations about recorded classical music are what I wake up to in the morning, and they tuck me in at night. Beethoven composed 32 piano sonatas. I own 5 complete recordings of them, having discarded twice as many, some repurchased and relinquished more than once. Stored away somewhere in our attic are 2 sets I will never listen to again. I have 5 complete versions of the 16 Beethoven string quartets and 6 collections of the 9 symphonies. At one time or another, I've owned almost all the recorded Beethoven symphony cycles issued on CD, including the 3 out-of-favor sets also currently hiding in the attic. If at this very moment I were to begin to play all the collected Beethoven works on my shelves, and if I did nothing else, it would take me weeks to hear it all. And that's just Beethoven. Many CDs on my shelves have made only cursory visits to my stereo's disc drive, if I've listened to them at all. Others have never had a hearing, languishing as orphans on my shelves. Ray is suspicious. "Have you been obsessing and buying?" she's asked me a number of times in the past few weeks. I look directly at my life partner of 39 years, and I lie. I tell myself I don't want to hurt her. Nonsense. I fear losing her affection. I don't want to look bad in her eyes. I'm afraid of her anger. That's what I don't want. I've given hints, almost as if I wanted to be caught. "You look stressed," Ray remarks one evening in early January. "Yes, it's all these CDs," I begin to reply. She eyes me. My embarrassment is instant and palpable. "I mean all these CVs I have to email for my speaking engagements." A clumsy recovery. I'm guilty as sin, and I must look it. How I managed to escape is beyond me. For a moment, I consider confessing, as eventually I always do. The following week, over morning coffee, I look up from the newspaper. "Ah," I remark to Ray, "the Vancouver Opera is doing Don Giovanni in March." "Don Giovanni," Ray muses. "I don't know that one. What's it about?" "The Don Juan story. The obsessive womanizer. He's this creative, charming, and energetic man. A daring adventurer, but a coward morally who never finds peace within. His erotic passion is insatiable. No matter how often it's consummated, it leaves him restless and dissatisfied. And his poetic talent and his drive for mastery only serve his relentless need to possess. It's always about the next acquisition. He even keeps a notebook listing his amorous conquests. He has many, many opportunities for salvation, but he spurns them all. He torments others and sacrifices his own mortal soul. He scorns repentance, and in the end, he's dragged down to hell." Ray glances at me with something like surprise, or is it a knowing smirk? "You described that so eloquently," she says. "You brought the character alive. He's obviously close to your heart." "True, he is. I've purchased 4 versions of this Mozart masterpiece in the last month, adding to the 2 already in my collection. I've never listened to any of them from start to finish. And I've been lying, withholding all this from Ray. Actually, I'm a small-time, far less glamorous Don Giovanni. I cheat with operas, not women. Some may find it difficult to understand how the desire to own 6 versions of Don Giovanni can be called an addiction. What's wrong with loving music? With having a passion for great art? With the search for the sublime in aesthetic experience? We humans need art and beauty in our lives. In fact, that's what makes us human. What distinguishes us from our defunct Neanderthal cousins is Homo sapiens' capacity for symbolic expression, our ability to represent our experience in abstract terms. That part of the prefrontal cortex didn't develop in the Neanderthal brain. Their species couldn't have produced a Mozart had they survived another million years. So really, isn't it human to want beauty? To crave it, even? And I do adore the music. It's both the most abstract form of art, capable of communicating without words or visual images, and the most immediate. For me, at least, it's the purest form of artistic expression. With or without words, it speaks eloquently of loss and joy, doubt and truth, despair and inspiration, earthly lust and the transcendent divine. Music challenges me, thrills me, fills me, moves me, softens my heart. It releases streams of emotion in me that I dammed up long ago in the rest of my life. As Thomas De Quincey writes in The Confessions of an English Opium Eater, music has the power to render life's passions exalted, spiritualized, sublimed, even if De Quincey thought he had to take opium to appreciate this. So, yes, I am passionate about music. But I'm also addicted, which is an altogether different ontological boxed set. Addictions, even as they resemble normal human yearnings, are more about desire than attainment. In the addicted mode, the emotional charge is in the pursuit and the acquisition of the desired object, not in the possession and enjoyment of it. The greatest pleasure is in the momentary satisfaction of yearning. The fundamental addiction is to the fleeting experience of not being addicted. The addict craves the absence of the craving state. For a brief moment, he's liberated from emptiness, from boredom, from lack of meaning, from yearning, from being driven, or from pain. He is free. His enslavement to the external, the substance, the object, or the activity, consists of the impossibility in his mind of finding within himself the freedom from longing or irritability. "I want nothing and fear nothing," said Zorba the Greek. "I'm free." There are not many Zorbas amongst us. In my addicted mode, the music still thrills, but it cannot release me from the need to pursue and acquire more and more. Its fruit is not joy, but disaffection. With each CD, I delude myself that now my collection will be complete. If only I could have that one, just one more time, I could rest satisfied. So runs the illusion. Just one more is the binding factor in the circle of suffering, writes the Buddhist monk and teacher Sakyong Mipham. My purest moment of freedom occurs after I park my car, hurry to Sakura's, and slowing down just before entering, draw a deep breath as I push the door open. For this nanosecond, life is limitless possibility. We can perceive the infinite in music only by searching for this quality in ourselves, writes the pianist and conductor Daniel Barenboim. Very true, but that's not the kind of infinite the addict seeks. When you get right down to it, it's the adrenaline I'm after, along with the precious reward chemicals that will flood my brain when I hold the new CD in hand, providing an all-too-temporary reprieve from the stress of my driven state. But I've barely left the store before the adrenaline starts pumping through my circulation again, my mind fixated on the next purchase. Anyone who's addicted to any kind of pursuit, whether it's sex or gambling or shopping, is after that same fix of homegrown chemicals. This behavior has been recurring for decades since my children were... Wait. The behavior has been recurring? What a neat way to put it outside of myself, as if it lived as an independent entity. No, I have been doing this for decades, since my children were small. Many years, I was spending thousands of dollars on compact discs. Dropping a few hundred dollars in an hour or two was no stretch. My all-time record came close to $8,000 in 1 week. I was cushioned from economic disaster by the income I earned as one of the self-sacrificing, read workaholic, physicians much admired by the world at large. As I've written elsewhere, it was easy for me to justify all the spending as compensation for the hard work I was doing, one addiction providing an alibi for the other. The confusing part was this. Both behavior dependencies represented genuine aspects of me, each distorted out of proportion. My addiction to music and books could masquerade as an aesthetic passion, and my addiction to work as a service to humanity. And I do have aesthetic passion, and I do wish to serve humanity. I'm not the only person in the world intoxicated by classical music, and I'm far from alone in owning multiple sets of recorded masterpieces. So are all these other enthusiasts addicted too? No, not all, but many of them are. I see them in the stores and read their comments on the World Wide Web. One addict knows another. Any passion can become an addiction, but then how to distinguish between the two? The central question is who is in charge, the individual or their behavior? It's possible to rule a passion, but an obsessive passion that a person is unable to rule is an addiction. And the addiction is the repeated behavior that a person keeps engaging in, even though he knows it harms himself or others. How it looks externally is irrelevant. The key issue is a person's internal relationship to the passion and its related behaviors. If in doubt, ask yourself one simple question. Given the harm you're doing to yourself and others, are you willing to stop? If not, you're addicted. And if you're unable to renounce the behavior or keep your pledge when you do, you're addicted. There is, of course, a deeper, more ossified layer beneath any kind of addiction. The denial state in which, contrary to all reason and evidence, you refuse to acknowledge that you're hurting yourself or anyone else. In the denial state, you're completely resistant to asking yourself any questions at all. But if you want to know, look around you. Are you closer to the people you love after your passion has been fulfilled, or more isolated? Have you come more truly into who you really are, or are you left feeling hollow? The difference between passion and addiction is that between a divine spark and a flame that incinerates. The sacred fire through which Moses, experienced the presence of God on Mount Horeb did not annihilate the bush from which it arose. And Yahweh's messenger was seen by him in the flame of a fire out of the midst of a bush. He saw, "Here, the bush is burning with fire, and the bush is not consumed." Passion is divine fire. It enlivens and makes holy. It gives light and yields inspiration. Passion is generous because it's not ego-driven. Addiction is self-centered. Passion gives and enriches. Addiction is a thief. Passion is a source of truth and enlightenment. Addictive behaviors lead you into darkness. You're more alive when you are passionate, and you triumph whether or not you attain your goal. But an addiction requires a specific outcome that feeds the ego. Without that outcome, the ego feels empty and deprived. A consuming passion that you are helpless to resist, no matter what the consequences, is an addiction. You may even devote your entire life to a passion, but if it's truly a passion and not an addiction, you'll do so with freedom, joy, and a full assertion of your truest self and values. In addiction, there's no joy, freedom, or assertion. The addict lurks shame-faced in the shadowy corners of her own existence. I glimpse shame in the eyes of my addicted patients in the downtown East Side, and in their shame, I see mirrored my own. Addiction is passion's dark simulacrum, and, to the naive observer, its perfect mimic. It resembles passion in its urgency and in the promise of fulfillment, but its gifts are illusory. It's a black hole. The more you offer it, the more it demands. Unlike passion, its alchemy does not create new elements from old. It only degrades what it touches and turns it into something less, something cheaper. Am I happier after one of my self-indulgent sprees? Like a miser, in my mind I recount and catalog my recent purchases. A furtive Scrooge, hunched over and rubbing his hands together with acquisitive glee, his heart growing ever colder. In the wake of a buying binge, I am not a satisfied man. Addiction is centrifugal. It sucks energy from you, creating a vacuum of inertia. A passion energizes you and enriches your relationships. It empowers you and gives strength to others. Passion creates. Addiction consumes. First the self, and then the others within its orbit. The hit musical Little Shop of Horrors offers a brilliant metaphorical image of addiction. Seymour, a little nebbish of a flower shop clerk, played most famously in the 1986 film version by Rick Moranis, takes pity on a strange and unusual little plant that's dying of malnutrition. It brings the shop some much-needed business, but there's a problem. No one can figure out what the plant, named Audrey II after Seymour's sweetheart, needs for nourishment, until one night, Seymour accidentally pricks a finger, and the plant hungrily swallows the drops of blood dripping from the wound. Only temporarily appeased, the plant wants more, and Seymour dutifully offers up another dose of his precious plasma. The plant then takes on a personality and voice of its own. Piteously, the little plant pleads and cajoles, promising to be Seymour's slave. But then it issues an abrupt command.
Feed me, Seymour!
Terrified, Seymour does as he's told. The plant thrives and becomes huger and hungrier, and Seymour weakens and becomes anemic, morally as well as physically. When it looks as if he's going to be bled, literally dry, Seymour stumbles on the idea of feeding the plant human corpses and is led into a new part-time vocation, murder. By the finale, Seymour is forced to wage a heroic battle against the bloodthirsty Audrey II. Bent on conquest and power, the plant no longer even bothers to feign friendship. So it is with addiction. Beginning with only the few drops of blood you're ready to donate at first, it soon consumes enough to dominate and rule you. Then it starts to prey on those around you, and you must struggle to extinguish it. I lose myself when caught in one of my addictive spirals. Gradually, I feel an ebbing of moral strength and experience myself as hollow. Emptiness stares out from behind my eyes. I fear that even my friends at Sikora's who sell me the goods can see through my thin mask. There is nothing behind the facade but an organism palpitating for instant gratification. It's not a music lover standing at the counter, but an abject weakling. I sense they pity me. Everywhere I go, I find it an effort to impersonate myself. Nurses at St. Paul's Hospital ask me how I am. Fine, I say. I'm good. What I don't say is, I'm obsessed. I just blew in from the record store, and I can hardly wait to get through my work here so I can rush down to the car to listen to this opera or that symphony. Then, unless I go to the store to pick up more stuff, I'll go home and lie to my wife. And I'm feeling guilty as hell. That's how I am. Self-deprecating, pessimistic, or negative comments creep into my conversations. Someone on the ward compliments my work. I attempt a joke. Oh, you can fool some of the people some of the time. No joke, that. They look at me strangely and protest that they meant it. Of course they did, but in my shame, I don't believe I deserve any praise. A secret addiction comes equipped with praise deflectors. I become increasingly cynical about the world. Politics, people, possibility, the future. Every morning I get into a hostile argument with the newspaper, resenting it for what it says or doesn't say. The Globe and Mail, in its news slant editorials and choice of columnists, favors corporations, the mainstream parties, and neocon foreign policymakers. But the poor old Globe is just being true to its blue-blooded capitalist self. It's still the best paper in Canada, and I'm the one who chooses to fund it with my subscription dollars. So why am I yelling at it over coffee? My negativity stems from my internal dissatisfaction, my harsh self-critique. The Globe doesn't speak the truth as I see it, neither do I. The Globe justifies selfish acquisitiveness and exonerates dishonesty? Look who's talking. Would that the spread of negativity were confined to my prickly relationship with print journalism. No, I become increasingly and reflexively critical, irritable, and self-righteous with my teenage daughter. The more I indulge myself, the more judgmental I am toward her. I can't be optimistic and believe in her growth and development when I know I'm sabotaging my own. How can I see the best in her when I'm blind to all but the worst in myself? Our interactions are tense. At age 17, she's at no loss for words or body language to communicate her displeasure. My relationship with Ray loses vitality. Because my internal world is dominated by obsession, I have little to say, and what I do say rings hollow in my own ears. Because my attention is pulled inward, the interest I offer her becomes dutiful rather than genuine. When I'm in one of my addictive cycles, it's almost as if I were engaged in a sexual affair with all the attendant obsession, lying, and manipulation. Above all, I'm absent. It's impossible to be fully present when you're putting up walls to keep from being seen. Intimacy and spontaneity are sacrificed. Something's got to give, and it does. Sometimes for days, sometimes for weeks and months. When they were much younger, I'd keep my children waiting or hurry them along to suit my purposes. If I could, I'd expunge from my personal history the time I left my 11-year-old son at a comic book shop after a soccer game with one of his teammates. "I'll be back in 15 minutes," I said. It was nearly an hour before I returned. I'd not only run to the store across the street, I'd also driven to another one, downtown, on my quest for whatever was at that moment my must-have immediately recording. My son's face was clouded with anxiety and bewilderment when he finally saw me at the comic book shop door. I lied to my wife daily for weeks and months at a time. I'd rush into the house, stashing my latest purchases on the porch, pretending to be home and grounded, but inwardly I could think of nothing but the music. When the reckoning came, as it always did, I made guilty confessions and soon-to-be-broken promises. I hated myself, and this self-loathing manifested itself in the harsh, controlling, and critical ways I deal with my sons and my daughter. When we're preoccupied with serving our own false needs, we can't endure seeing the genuine needs of other people, least of all those of our children. Perhaps the nadir, but certainly not the end, of my addictive years came when I left a woman in labor to run over the bridge in midday traffic to Socorro's. Even then, I would have had time to return to the hospital for the delivery had I not begun to cast about for other recordings to buy. I murmured apologies when I got back, but no explanations. Everyone was most understanding, even my disappointed patient. After all, Dr. Mate is a busy man. He can't be everywhere at once. I enjoyed a reputation in Vancouver as a physician who extended himself for his pregnant patients and would support them compassionately through their delivery. Not this time. This baby was born without me. Her name is Carmela. She's a beautiful 20-year-old dancer and university student. I told her mother, Joyce, the full story many years ago. This is not the first public confession I've made. I've written and spoke about my addictions before. And the truth is that, as of this writing, neither my public acknowledgments of my behavior, nor my thorough understanding of its impact on myself and my family, has stopped me from repeating the cycle. I've authored 3 books and received letters and emails from readers the world over, thanking me for having helped them transform their lives. Yet I have continued to choose patterns that darken my spirit, alienate those closest to me, and drain my vitality. Since I wrote this chapter in February 2006, I have made significant changes in my relation to my addictive habits as I will describe later. In January 2006, when I'm in the midst of an extended CD obsession, Sean comes moaning into my office. "I'm messing up," he says. "I'm puking and shitting. I've been doing heroin. Oh, man." Sean has been in a recovery home for months. I haven't seen him for a long time, but he did call regularly, proudly reporting on his progress and his determination to stay clean. Once he left a voicemail. "I'm calling to say that I appreciate all your help. I just want to say thanks, man." Now he's back in the downtown East Side. Pale, bedraggled, emaciated, unwashed. He's been living in the streets for weeks, but plans to admit himself to a Christian rehabilitation camp. "Don't you think you should be back on the methadone?" I suggest. Sean eagerly downs his first dose before recounting the details of this most recent relapse. "I don't know why, Doc. I thought I'd just use one time, just the one time, and that was it."
"So are you going through with the Christian rehab thing?"
"My family is pushing me, but I'm not up to it."
"Have you told them that?"
"No."
"What stops you from being straight with them?"
"Hurting them. They've helped me so much and I turned around and failed so miserably." I'm instantly filled with judgment. Annoyed by his neediness and weakness of will, that is, by my own, I want to teach him a lesson.
"I don't believe you," I counter. "Not that you don't mean it, but you're not being honest with yourself. You're not worried about hurting them. You're already hurting them."
"Yes, I am. But I don't want to go to this Christian place. I know what it's all about. It's really tough there, a complete schedule. It's harsh and rigid."
"That's not the point. I'm talking about telling your family the truth about how you feel and what you're up to. You just don't want to face the hassle of being clear with them. You're afraid of their judgment or of your own. You're too chicken to be honest." Sean throws me a direct glance, an abashed smile on his face.
"Yeah, that's how it is, Doc."
"Well then, get off it. Be open about what you want and what you don't want. That much you do owe your family." Doc, having pushed his addicted patient to tell the truth, will now go home and deceive his wife, his briefcase stuffed with the latest haul of Sikora's loot. Chapter 10, 12-Step Journal, April 5th, 2006. Tonight I will attend my first 12-step group. I'm apprehensive. Do I belong there? What will I say? "Hi, I'm Gabor, and I am a..." A what? An addict? Or a voyeur? I've never been hooked on substances. I've never tried cocaine or opiates, partly due to the fear that I'd like them too well. I've been drunk exactly twice in my life during my college years. Both incidents ended with bouts of vomiting, the first time in the vehicle of Lieutenant Jeunesse, my company commander at the Canadian Officers Training Corps summer boot camp at Borden, Ontario. He was driving me and several comrades back to the barracks after an evening of carousing at the officers' club.
"You made a mess of my car last night,"
the lieutenant shouted at me on the parade square early next morning.
"Sorry, sir,"
I groaned by way of reply, drawing myself to full attention.
"I wasn't thinking."
I expect to meet people at AA who, by and large, have had their lives devastated by alcohol or other drugs. For months or years at a time, their minds and bodies have been tortured by the craving for substances. They've been racked by withdrawal pangs, their throats parched, their brains beset by terrors and hallucinations. How can I compare myself with them? Will it feel like I'm slumming? How can I mention my petty dysfunctions alongside the tales of affliction I'm likely to hear tonight? What right do I have to claim even the dubious distinction of being a real addict? Calling myself an addict in such company may be nothing more than an attempt to excuse my selfishness and lack of discipline. I fear being recognized. People may have seen me on TV or read something I've written. It's one thing to be on stage as an authority figure, addressing an audience on stress or ADHD or parenting or childhood development,
and to acknowledge that I've had problems with impulse control over the years. In that context, my public self-revelations are received as honest, authentic, and even courageous. It's quite another matter to confess as a peer to a group who have had a much closer confrontation with life's gritty realities than I have, that I'm powerless, that my addictive behaviors often get the better of me, that I'm unhappy. Of course, in my mind, there also lurks a craving to be recognized. If I'm not my public persona, doctor, writer, who am I? It whispers. Without my achievements and the opportunity to display my status, intelligence, and wit, I fear I do not cut a very impressive figure. Wryly, I observe my ego do its frantic dance. It just can't get no satisfaction. The meeting takes place in a church basement, which is surprisingly full. Behind a lectern at the front, a middle-aged woman whose amiable features reveal shyness mixed with authority calls to order a raucous, polyglot crowd of people seated on wooden chairs. I survey the audience through the gradually subsiding din. Calloused hands, jeans, cowboy boots, ravaged faces, hardened looks, nicotine-stained teeth, whiskey gravel voices, earthy back-slapping humor, easy camaraderie. A rough-edged, blue-collared, East Vancouver gathering. Young women sport green and pink neon stripes and spiky punk hairdos. Scruffy middle-aged fellows exchange whispered jokes and toothless smiles. The scalp of the old man in front of me gleans between rows of thin white hair, like shiny furrows in a plowed winter field. I feel instantly at home, and I realize why. The hyperkinetic, ADD-like energy of this bunch resonates with my own. "Hi, I'm Maureen. I'm an alcoholic," the chairperson begins. "Hi, Maureen," the audience hails her from all sides of the room. A few more people are identified. "I'm Elaine, alcoholic." "George, alcoholic." Loud cheers greet each name. Newcomers are invited to introduce themselves. I sit quietly. "Welcome all. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking." First, I have to start drinking, I think. "We are here to surrender, to let go of the old ideas that keep us stuck." I don't do surrender. I'm not even sure what that means. As if in response to my inner commentator, a tall, burly man strides to the lectern. He has a thick nose, and his oiled hair is slicked back into a ducktail. Looking at him, you'd feel you'd want to avoid him on a dark street. He speaks with the authority of someone who's looked himself in the eye without blinking. "I'm Peter, alcoholic." "Hi, Peter," the loud chorus responds. "I'm here to tell you about surrender," he begins. "I'm here to tell you how hip, slick, cool I was when I first came to AA. You wouldn't believe how slick and cool." Snickers all around. "Anything I wanted, I could get with my mouth, and if I couldn't, I'd take it with my fists. I robbed my own mother once. That still hurts. When I first came here, all I wanted was to sober up enough so I could concentrate on my flourishing drug business. My last binge 6 years ago ended with 3 days in the bathroom where I kept puking, sweating, and shitting myself. I didn't dare be more than a few feet away from the toilet or the shower." Boisterous laughter all around the room. "After 3 days of bathroom living, I reconnected the phone. 3 messages. The first from my landlord: Peter, you're evicted. The second from my mother: Peter, you can heal. The third from my friend: Peter, I've surrendered and it works." It's lining up perfect, I thought. If that jerk can surrender, so can I. I was still in my better then phase. Nods of recognition, guffaws, and applause. I looked around and asked myself what surrender would look like. In my case, it looked like a large green Glad garbage bag into which I gathered all my drug paraphernalia, along with my little phone books of business contacts. Wouldn't need them anymore. I chucked it all into the bin in the back alley. I'm struck by that. Surrender is not some abstract, airy-fairy spiritual concept. It's individual, and it's practical. At the same time, I do feel like a voyeur here. My life, and this man's, cannot be measured on the same scale of suffering.